So I also have an announcement. I'm going to be leading a discussion in the Prairie View Coffee House in Union South on Friday afternoon. The Wisconsin Union Directorate has a Friday afternoon conversation event, afternoon conversations they call it. I'll be leading a discussion on unconditional basic income, something we talked about in the last part of the previous section of the course. So if you're interested in having a chance to talk to me and others, they say there's usually 15 or 20 students who show up. You get free coffee and a donut, apparently. That's part of the deal for these Friday afternoon discussions. So that's 3:30 this Friday in the Prairie View Coffee House in Union South. And just to remind you once again, tomorrow I have regular office hours from 1 to 2. And I hope that my slideshow on Tuesday will convince some of you who have been a little hesitant to come to see me that I won't bite and that we can have a nice, relaxed chat. So I'll be there, and if so many of you want to talk to me that we can't do it all between 1 and 2, I'll just stay there until I have to go to the Prairie View coffee shop. All right, now back to the question of gender inequality and its transformations, the final topic in this middle part of the course on inequality. In the last lecture, we reviewed the kind of underlying sociological idea of gender and gender inequality, and then looked at the historical record, what's happened. And the simple one-line answer to what's happened is there's been an extraordinarily profound transformation of gender relations in the last century, for sure, if you want to extend it that far back, but really accelerating, dramatically accelerating in the last 40 or 50 years. So here's the question, if we're trying to explain these trends. Women have always tried to increase their autonomy and reduce their subjugation. But throughout most of history, these struggles have produced at best minimal changes. Why do these struggles produce big changes sometimes and not others? Why in the second half of the 20th century? Why then? Why was there such massive transformation at that point? Now, this is a general kind of question to ask sociologically about history. So some of you may be history majors. Many of you may be interested in history, even if you're not majoring in it. What we observe in history is that there are historical moments when big changes happen. And sometimes there's a temptation to focus too narrowly just on the specifics of what happens that produces the changes. So you can study transformation of gender by looking at the various lawsuits that were filed, the various protests that occurred, the actions of individuals, and you can perhaps convince yourself that the explanation for the transformation is all because of these events, these things that happen. But there's a more difficult question to ask, which is why did they happen then and not earlier? Will we encounter the same problem around race? The civil rights movement was successful in the from the mid-1950s through the 60s. We call that the civil rights era. But it wasn't the case that opposition to racial segregation only started then. There had been efforts right from the beginning of the 20th century, indeed even earlier, to transform racial domination. Why did it succeed suddenly in that period and not earlier? That's a really hard kind of question to ask, because you're asking why something doesn't happen, right? That's sort of hard to really nail down, trying to explain. Sometimes social theorists call this explaining non-events. So what we're trying to do then is figure out what's special about the period after World War II. Well, here's basically the centerpiece of the answer, and then we will nail this down through more detail. While women have tried throughout history to increase their autonomy and reduce their subordination, they could only succeed in doing this on a large scale once social conditions had changed in ways that made existing gender power relations fragile. So there's this idea that something's happening which is making a system of domination vulnerable. And it gets vulnerable before it actually collapses. There's something that's eroding, undermining the integrity of a system. Now, to figure that out, what you need to do is to understand what about the previous system made it sort of locked in? What's the array of social processes that reinforce and keep stable a form of domination? And then we look at which elements of that array of interlocking forces begins to crumble. When it weakens, that's when it can be attacked successfully. The strategies of transformation did not themselves undermine these foundations. The foundations were undermined by social change that weren't really strategies. That is, they weren't strategies with the purpose of undermining male domination. Male domination, the foundations get eroded kind of in a subterranean way. You can think of this, words like erosion, those are geological terms, right? They're things that happen to the foundations of a house, and then suddenly the house collapses because something was going on that you didn't see. Well, let's try to unpack this to understand what generated this opportunity for massive transformation. There are three basic processes we're going to look at. First, there's a decline in a coherent interest among men to defend male domination. Now, that's an important thing to think about. You know, it's not just the strength of opposition, how mobilized were women to challenge these relations. There's also the question, how invested are men in defending them? Or did men's interest in defending their domination within these relations begin to have cracks and inconsistencies? So that's the first theme. The second is the erosion of the institutional system of female domesticity. That's a term that some people have used to describe the earlier configuration. So we can just call it a system because it had a bunch of elements which reinforced each other. The system of female domesticity, which eroded women's interest in traditional gender relations. So that changes too. That gets eroded as well. And then finally, the increase in the capacity for actual challenge. All right, so let's look at these three things. First, the decline of a coherent male interest in male domination. Well, here's, I think, the central thing that's happening, kind of behind the scenes, in a way. After the Second World War, throughout the developed industrial capitalist world, there were economic changes which dramatically increased the demand for literate labor, particularly clerical labor, that's the sort of archetype, but not just clerical workers. For literate labor, for labor that was able to read and write and in some cases calculate, so mathematical numeracy as well as literacy, there was a rapid increase in the economic demand for literate labor by male employers. Well, if you have a rapid demand for literate labor, you need to find literate employees, not just manual employees. And you look at the potential labor force, there's this vast untapped labor force of people who are literate in every Western developed industrial society. And they just happen to be women. That's a very attractive labor force, especially because at the beginning of the process, you didn't have to pay them very much because of the gendered conceptions of appropriate pay for different kinds of work. What this means is that men who are in positions of considerable influence, employers, in a market economy, in a capitalist economy, well, that's an important category of actors. They are advertising for jobs not specifically initially targeted towards women, that is, it's not jobs that say only women may apply. And they see that the relevant labor force that they could pull into these jobs are women. So what that means is that the interest in men in keeping women out of the labor force declines. There's now a significant part of the population that really wants to have more women in the labor force because that's a solution to a problem, inadequate labor supply of educated women. Now you could imagine, maybe you could have dealt with that through immigration. It's not so easy. You know, immigration has all sorts of interesting complications, as we know, but you want people literate in your language, so where are you going to get enough literate English speakers to fill the service sector and clerical jobs? But you can't exactly import them all from Britain, because British employers have the same problem. Obviously, there's this huge reservoir of non-employed literate labor out of the labor force. So that's the core of the decline of male interests in reproducing existing forms of male domination. But secondly, and here's, I think, this is really the heart of the matter. There's what we can call the crisis of female domesticity, which really begins in the late 50s, early 60s, and then accelerates dramatically, this crisis of female domesticity. So to understand this, let's first look at the traditional system, the traditional supports for domesticity. And the key idea here to remember is this is a coherent system. The different pieces fit together. They reinforce each other. It creates a configuration which sustains in a stable way this particular model for how gender relations should be organized. First, stable marriages and personal relations fostered domesticity. It gave women a long time horizon. If you got married, you could expect to stay married. So if there was a male breadwinner earning enough to provide for what's called a family wage, that is, men's wages were high enough in this system of female domesticity, male wages were high enough to support a family for a very broad segment of the population. Now, that was never really true for the poor. It was always true for poor families that women had to work to generate some income for the family. Even if they didn't go for jobs outside the home, they would take in laundry, for example, do all sorts of part-time work if the male breadwinner did not earn a family wage. But for a large segment of the American population, in this era of stable domesticity, the male breadwinner earned a family wage, and marriages were stable, which meant that women could count on, well into the future, economic security. This was combined with blocked work opportunities. So if it's not so bad staying in the family as a homemaker because there's enough income coming into the family and you can count on the marriage lasting, because divorce is heavily stigmatized, very low rates of divorce, so if that's the configuration around your time horizons, and in any case, the opportunities aren't great out there in the market. And blocked opportunities were really significant. There were official marriage bars, so single women could get some jobs, but if they got married, they were fired. In the United States, I don't know when this practice ended, but school teachers for a long time couldn't be married. In the Netherlands, until the 1950s, if you were a school teacher and you got married, you had to leave your job. You weren't allowed to be a married school teacher. It's called a marriage bar. And lots of jobs just excluded women, either formally or informally. So the opportunities weren't all that great. And at any rate, you had a stable marriage with a long time horizon and a family wage. And thus the family wage made domesticity economically feasible. There was also, and this is an interesting part of the configuration that's not so emphasized, but I think is actually quite important. There was a dense social network that supported domesticity. You know, in the 1950s, if you were a stay-at-home mom, during the baby boom, I'm a boomer, I'm an early boomer, you know, born right after World War II. If you were a stay-at-home mom in the late 40s and 50s, raising three or four children, larger family sizes, you could count on lots of neighbors doing the same thing. Now that's important. It's important not just because you might be conforming to what other people are doing. That actually provided us a network of social support. If you had an emergency and you had to take a kid to the doctor, you could knock on a neighbor's door and they would take care of your kids for the afternoon. There was a dense neighborhood-based network of social support, not just in neighborhoods, in churches, broader communities, which meant that to be a stay-at-home mom, you were not living an isolated existence. You were part of a community of stay-at-home moms. And those social supports reinforce the system. It makes it a more interesting and sustainable way of life. And finally, that was a period where the cultural norms were really strong, supporting this ideal of female domesticity in the male breadwinner. I was listening to a old-time radio program. They have them on NPR on Saturday evenings. And there was a kids program about some kid, the All-American Boy, I forget the exact title. But they also broadcast the advertisements, which I thought were interesting. And they were instructing the children listening to this radio program, go tell your mother to buy Wheaties for you. You know, it was an advertisement for the Breakfast of Champions, Wheaties. And it was all directed towards kids telling their mothers what to buy for their breakfasts. That's, of course, an interesting feature of consumerism, getting at parents through their children. That certainly continued. But the particular tone of this just naturalized the fact that it would be mothers who would be there at home who would be worried about the Wheaties, and the kids should address their parents. That's part of the cultural norm, just the taken for grantedness of how the world is. That's the traditional system, and all of these things fit together. They reinforced each other. Well, what happens? This really, the cracks in that system begin in the 60s, and they accelerate. First, the decline of stable marriages means that women can't count on the support of husbands forever. If there's roughly a 50% chance of a marriage dissolving. You know, the rise of divorce rates begin to approach a 50-50 chance. Well, that's a kind of bad bet if you're going to count on financial support and security. It's a bad bet to keep yourself out of the labor market indefinitely. It's a really bad situation to have the first time you go into the labor market in a serious way in the aftermath of a divorce. It's a much more practical insurance function, if you will. You're insuring your own economic well-being by entering the labor force and keeping your labor market skills up. The expansion of work opportunities increased the viability of alternatives to domesticity. That was driven by that first point I made, and why men were no longer so opposed to women entering the labor force, because male employers needed women in the labor force. That expanded work opportunities, and that made the alternative to domesticity a practical alternative, a practical thing people could do. Now, what also began to happen was a decline of the family wage. This really kicks off in the 1970s. When we talk about the stagnation of male wages beginning in the early 1970s, and being basically stagnant since then, really what's happening is the sense of the male wage being a family wage sufficient to support a family comfortably, that begins to decline for a very large proportion of the population. A crucial reason why household income hasn't stagnated to the extent that individual wages, male wages, have stagnated is precisely because the increased supply of female labor in the labor market. That's compensated for this stagnation and indeed decline of male wages during this period. The entry of women into the labor market because of these increased opportunities led to an erosion of the dense social network. So those women who wanted to stay stay-at-home moms, for whom that was a life choice that conformed to their identities and which they felt were fulfilling, that role became more difficult, more isolating, less embedded in a dense network of supports. It's much tougher to be a stay-at-home mom in a neighborhood where you're the only person who's doing that than in a neighborhood where everybody's doing it. Not just tougher because you might feel a little bit out of place, tougher because the actual social supports aren't there to make that job, that way of life, easier. And then finally, which contributed to this collapse of this coherent domesticity, were real serious challenges to the cultural norms and traditional sexism of the previous period. And this contributed to new kinds of identities. This is where I think the women's movement and feminism as a kind of ideological challenge to male domination, this is where I think it's had some of its biggest impacts in attacking cultural sexism. Indeed, we shifted from a normal way of things being to endorse cultural sexism to a very strong presence of explicit anti-sexism. This was seen as very aggressive and strident in the 1970s, when the women's movement as a collective action in the streets was at its strongest. And it was ridiculed in much of the media. But the ridicule didn't kill off the anti-sexism. In some ways, it brought attention to it. That cultural anti-sexism then helped to strengthen the political challenges which the women's movement waged to change the laws in ways that would then open up even more space. Laws about discrimination, laws about legal rights, laws about sports, like we talked about last time. So this combination of things, male interest in maintaining the old order begins to weaken because some men begin to have interests in change. And then this unraveling of the system which locked the old structures in place, that creates this fragility of the old structures, which then makes challenge more successful. Well, where does that leave us? How should we think about the world today? First, the fundamental changes that have happened, I think, are really irreversible. Now, I could be wrong about that. You know, I mean, it's often thought that things are irreversible. There's a very chilling book by Margaret Atwood called The Handmaid's Tale. It's a dystopian novel. Dystopia is spelled D-Y-S-topia. It's the opposite of utopia. Utopia is the vision of the future of peace and justice and harmony. Dystopia is a vision of the future as repressive, apocalyptic, barbaric. There are many more good dystopian novels than utopian novels. It seems to be something about the character of literary production that it's easier to imagine an interesting, terrible world than an interesting, cheerful, wonderful world. It's like with movies. There are very good movies, very few good movies, in which the central theme is cheerfulness. that are serious movies that really, you know, explore what's interesting about happiness. There's many more movies that explore what's dramatic and interesting about tragedy and depression. Well, The Handmaid's Tale imagines a world in the future in which male domination returns with a vengeance. It's absolute and total domination of women, who are seen as merely the source of biological reproduction under the control of men. And it occurs because of a patriarchal counter-revolution in America, and Canada remains a kind of gendered emancipatory zone, and there's a sort of underground railway for women to escape from the United States to Canada. Margaret Atwood is the author, and she's giving a talk. She's a Canadian novelist, really quite a brilliant and interesting person. She's giving a talk in Madison next Monday night, and on some new work of hers. I'm sure it will be interesting, and The Handmaid's Tale is definitely worth reading. Well, I think that's a fantasy, a dark fantasy. I just think the basic changes are pretty much irreversible. The dramatic decline in family size is unlikely to be reversed for all sorts of reasons. And the dramatic decline of family size also undermines the role of female domesticity. You know, if you were having 5 or 6 children or more spread out over a 10 or 15 year period of giving birth to those children, well, then you had a 25-year period where you were having children in the home. That's a big chunk of your life. And if you want to live the life as a person deeply involved in taking care of children, of your children, and you have a large family size, well, that itself reinforces female domesticity. The dramatic decline of family size seems to be very unlikely to be reversed for all sorts of obvious reasons, in addition to the environmental and ecological issues involved with rapid population growth. But I don't think people are restricting their family size primarily out of concern for the environment. Some people do that, but that's not the main reason. It's more that as women gain a sense of autonomy and wanting to craft their own life plans as autonomous adults with their own visions of how they want to live their lives, they may indeed most often do still want to have children, but they don't want their lives defined by that role alone. And it's just easier to combine other ways of living with having children if you have small families. It's also the case, and this is another issue, we won't have time to discuss it, in earlier eras, large family sizes were a crucial form of insurance, of old age insurance, for both men and women. You know, if you have no safety net in the society and people couldn't save for retirement, one way that you can ensure that somebody is going to care for you and care about you when you're old is to have lots of children. Since any one child might not be able to do so, but if you have lots of children, they can pool resources to see that you have at least a tolerable old age. So there's a sense in which large family sizes were part of an insurance function in eras before there was Social Security and retirement pensions and the like. It's true everywhere in the world that as incomes rise, as public health increases, so that infant mortality and mortality is more under control, that family sizes decline. So I don't think that's likely to reverse. The traditional marriage stability is unlikely to be restored. It's unlikely that we will return to an era in which divorce is stigmatized, and in which young people who fall in love and get married make a lifetime commitment, and no matter how much it deteriorates and how much they grow to be irritated with each other, they decide to stick it out just because it would be shameful to do otherwise. That once that cultural standard was broken, I don't believe it's reversible. Women's labor force participation is unlikely to be reversed. Now, it may have ups and downs, of course, depending upon economic conditions and other factors. It seems extremely implausible that we would go back to an era where only 5 or 10% of women with children would seek work outside of the home. Women's participation in powerful and influential positions is unlikely to decline. Indeed, if anything, it's likely to continue to increase. I don't see women saying, yeah, you know, really, we don't want to be elected into political office, etc. I mean, it just once that sense of capacity and empowerment has been brought into the social arena and people have discovered that they can indeed do these things as effectively as men, that gender is just not a very significant real factor, just a culturally constructed factor in determining the competence of people to be effective in these roles, it just seems extremely unlikely that those gains will be reversed. And finally, the degendering of traditional roles is also, I think, unlikely to be reversed. And one reason for that, which is not so often stressed, is the ways in which degendered roles are so beneficial for men as well. You know, this is a particular shtick of my own. If I look over my life of the things which have most deeply shaped my sense of meaning, being a father is absolutely as important as any other role I've had. And being an engaged father who took care of babies, I had a crib in my office. So, you know, 30 years ago, if I was urging you to come to my, well, a little more than 35 years ago, I guess I have to say now. 35 years ago, when I urged students to come to my office hours, frequently, there would be a toddler in my room, or certainly before they were too rambunctious babies. We shared childcare as much as possible, and I often brought my little ones to my office when I had office hours. Well, I felt that as a liberation. You saw that photo from Tuesday of me with these two other guys skiing in the High Sierras without shirts. I was part of a men's group. That was also part of the women's movement, having men's group to raise our consciousness about gender issues and to really take seriously in our discussions with each other what we wanted to be as men and what that meant. And basically the conclusion is that we wanted to be more like women. We wanted to live our lives in that more engaged way in caregiving, not just in the typical masculine things. Well, all I'm saying is one reason why I think degendering roles will have a sticky character. Once people live their lives that way, they won't want to go back to the more traditional, binary, polarized way of thinking of men and women and their appropriate ways of being in the world, is because it's enriching for men as well. If it was all loss for men, you know, if everything about more equality made life worse for men and just better for women, if it really was like that, it would be more vulnerable. You know, you could imagine a counteroffensive that might actually gain steam, but it isn't like that. This is why the transformation of gender relations, because it's bound up with the very deepest forms of meaning and intimacy in life, really is a different kind of problem of transformation than the transformation of other kinds of social relations like race or class, in which it's still the case, I think, that the dissolution of those forms of oppression make life better in general in a society. It doesn't have this grip on your personal, intimate life that I think gender does. And that's another reason why I think the traditional roles are unlikely to be reversed, reestablished. Now, by that I should say, let me just emphasize, I don't mean that everyone will, in any imaginable world, that everybody would live in this much more egalitarian set of gender relations. I'm just saying that the cultural standard that men and women should do separate things in life, that cultural standard won't be reestablished. There may be all sorts of variation. I certainly suspect in a world that I would like to see, I suspect that there'll be stay-at-home moms and stay-at-home dads. I don't see any inherent virtue in everybody working their tails off, doing both parenting and professional and, you know, occupational work outside of the home. That's good for some people, not for others. I just don't think it'll be a heavily gendered issue. It'll be a life choice issue. Okay, so that's the first point. Irreversibility of fundamental changes. The second general point to think about: there are winners and losers in every form of social change, and that's true around transformation of gender as well. Gender equality, to the extent that we are moving in that direction, extends opportunity and freedom of choice for women in general, but it also imposes some costs on some women and erodes some of the security that comes with traditional female dependency. Certain ways of life that are valued by many women and men are threatened by gender equality. That is, even though people have the freedom to choose traditional gender roles, there's no laws that say you cannot choose to live your life with traditional gender roles. And a certain percentage of the population does. It's possible to choose a life in which you have a 100% stay-at-home mom and a 100% male breadwinner, and they sit down at dinner at 6 o'clock every night with their three children. Well, if we carry on the traditional vision, it may be a smaller and smaller category, but you see what I mean. People are free to choose that, but it's harder to choose it. It's genuinely harder because all of those supports aren't present for it. And so there is, and particularly because once the cultural norm of divorce has been changed, so that it is no longer a shameful thing, which was an important impediment to getting a divorce, even in terrible marriages. People's sense of identities were threatened by that public disgrace. You'll see old movies from, you know, the 40s and 30s where that is just an agonizing issue for people, which it just isn't today. Even if divorces are always complicated and they bring heartbreak and they cause all sorts of suffering, it doesn't bring public shaming. And that's a crucial feature of the idea of it being a norm. Remember, at the very beginning of the class, we talked about norms as a form of, as a kind of rule. And like all rules, they're only rules if there is some kind of sanction for violating them. The cultural sanction for divorce used to be huge in many communities. That just isn't the case now. And that then makes these traditional ways of life harder to sustain. And that's a cost. When I say there are winners and losers, that is a cost on some people's lives. As I've emphasized, men have contradictory interests with respect to gender inequality. Men have much to gain from even more inequality, but they do have things to lose as well. The gains are opening up choices around parenting and work. The cult of masculinity blocks the full development of personhood in men. I mean, if you think, you know, the classic way of thinking about men is to emphasize this value of freedom. Well, men are less free in the sense of having the real possibility of making a variety of choices. Some of those choices are ruled out if they're trapped in the cult of male dominance and masculinity. That is an obstruction to the freedom of men to live certain kinds of lives. And as I said, my own prejudice in this is that for most men, maybe not all, living a life that involved deeper engagement in caregiving would actually be experienced as a richer life, not a demasculinized life. So those are real gains, but there are losses. There's more competition for higher level jobs. There's no doubt about it. You know, you have all these competent, self-assured, well-trained women competing for the same jobs as men, and unless the jobs, the desirable jobs, were to increase proportionately, the intensity of competition goes up. The end of gender-based privileges, the privilege of being able to exclude rivals from challenge, the end of gender-based privileges will mean losses for some men. Some men will not be able to achieve the status of high-level executives if it is the case that we finally break the class ceiling and women have equal opportunity for such promotions. So let's imagine two worlds. Now I'm looking towards the future. This is the status of things as they are. We've done at least some work towards explaining it. We've taken stock about irreversibility, talked about winners and losers. Here are two worlds to imagine. So here's world number one, possible worlds. The average wages of men and women are about the same. Labor market opportunities are pretty much equal for men and women in terms of earnings capacity. Good quality childcare is provided by the government or employers, either free or at very low cost. And there is generous paid parental leave for caregiving emergencies and early infant care. Not just at the birth of a child, but also caregiving emergencies around health issues and elder care, and generous paid parental leave for those necessities. So that's one world. And it's parental leave. It can be taken by either men or women. We should call it generous paid caregiving leave, because it isn't just for your role as a parent. It could be for your role as the child of an elderly person. That's world number one. Here's world number two. The average wages of women are about 75 to 80% the wages of men. There's no child care provided by government employers. Private daycare is expensive or of poor quality. And there's no paid parental leave for caregiving emergencies or early infant care. These are two different worlds. Two different worlds that set the background conditions under which people live their lives and navigate the difficulties around gender. The first of these is pretty much a description of Sweden and Denmark and other Northern European countries. The second one is the description of the US. This is the legally required paid parental leaves in various countries. In Sweden, there are 96 weeks, almost 2 years, of paid parental leaves. Now, it's not for that entire period at 100% of your prior wages. I don't remember the formula. It's for part of that period you get 90%, and for part of it you get 50%. But you can take leaves from work in which you're guaranteed your job back at the end, and you're paid the entire time, up to 96 weeks. Now that's a big outlier, but in most European countries, it's over 20 weeks. In the United States, it's a nice round non-number, zero. 0 weeks of legally enforced paid parental leaves. Now, some employers do provide paid parental leaves. Large corporations that are trying to attract, very energetic and highly educated workforce, Google and the like, they do provide paid parental leaves, but most American employers don't, and we certainly don't have the legal requirement to do so. I think of paid parental leaves as one of the crucial reforms. We'll discuss that and why in a moment, but as a crucial reform, not just because in and of itself it makes life easier for people, but it changes the environment under which people negotiate their micro-gender relations, the divisions of labor, the way roles develop. It makes it easier for people to fight over that, so to speak. and reach a more egalitarian equilibrium. It's a kind of side condition that makes it easier when people want to forge a more equality in their personal lives. Well, this then leads to free reforms, which I think are crucial for the future of gender equality. Pay equity, equal pay for comparable work, quality provision of childcare in neighborhoods and workplaces, and generous paid parental leaves. Let's look at each of these reforms. First, pay equity. Pay equity is usually thought of as equal pay for comparable work, not just equal pay for identical work. So equal pay for identical work is pretty easy. Indeed, anti-discrimination laws, as they exist, pretty much assure that if you have two people with the exact same job classification, with the same seniority, they should be on the same pay scale. What's tougher is this idea of equal pay for comparable work. So the example that's often given is that if you take a typically male job, the example that was often used, it may be a little less apt today than in the past, was a parking lot attendant were typically males, and nursery school teachers were typically female. Now, equal pay for comparable work would say that a parking lot attendant shouldn't be paid more than a nursery school teacher. If anything, it should be the reverse. It's a more responsibility, more skill. It's more important that it be done really well if you're a nursery school teacher than if you're a parking lot attendant. And yet, parking lot attendants in this stereotyped example earned more than preschool teachers, nursery school teachers. So comparable worth then means you have to somehow figure out, should be for work with of comparable worth. That would be a comparable worth rather than comparable work is the better way of saying it, and I should change the slide as a result. It should be comparable worth. Work of comparable worth is the idea. Well, that's a tricky business. You can see why that's not simple. It's not simple to say, well, how do you compare the nursery school teacher with the shop, with the parking lot attendant? What's the measure of worth of a job? And that's a problem. That makes this technically difficult. But there are solutions, and there are certainly solutions which improve over saying whatever the market pays for something is what defines its worth. Because the market is filled with barriers and discriminations and stereotypes and norms, that is cultural standards about appropriate pay, which have nothing to do with the quality of the work. The argument then is that we really need to develop a system which at least moves in the direction of pay equity. This removes one source of gender inequality in and of itself. If you can solve that problem, have rules in place which say we have to measure the worth of a job, its skills, its responsibilities, its importance in various ways, and then we have to equilibrate pay across such classifications, it removes one source of gender inequality. It also makes caregiving work more attractive to men. There will be more men that will want to be preschool teachers if the pay of preschool teachers was raised to the point of its importance and responsibility. And it's not the case, by the way, that preschool teachers everywhere are paid as lousily as they are in the United States. In Quebec, they have a very elaborate system of early infant child care that's substantially funded by the provincial government, in which the starting salaries for preschool teachers in 2010, which was the last time that I looked, I guess it was 2009, So it's a little bit out of date, but the starting salaries for a preschool teacher in Quebec were about $35,000 a year. Starting salaries. It's about twice what it is in the United States. And the preschools cost parents $7 a day in this early infant childcare system, with the rest of the costs being subsidized by the provincial government. Well, I think that's a terrific formula. You have the provincial government subsidizing early infant childcare, both to make it more affordable for parents, but also to guarantee living wages for the providers. It means that early infant childcare can be a real career for people. You can begin at $34,000. It's a modest but well above poverty line income, and you can move up in the course of a career. And that would make it more attractive to men. And having men involved in early infant childcare is one of the things that changes the norms. You know, you begin to see it as normal that men do this kind of work, and that which is normal becomes normative. Normal just means you see it. You know, it's not a rare event. Normative means it seems like it's okay. You know, it's not violating some standard. Pay equity also increases women's bargaining power in the home over the domestic division of labor. Now, this is a really interesting thing. For those of you who are, you know, would-be sociologists and plan to continue doing more in sociology, find all this super interesting and engaging. One of the interesting lines of work around gender inequality centers around the idea of bargaining that takes place in the family. Bargaining. Now, you all have lived in families, and you've seen your parents bargain over various things, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly. There's negotiations about the division of labor. Just a little anecdote in my own life. So after my men's group, I was gung-ho about, you know, doing my share. But it was just always harder. You know, we'd make lists, and I would do my list, and my wife would do her list. But she really did her list, and I sort of did my list. And we kept endlessly bargaining over it. Well, then she had this was still in graduate school. This was before children. It's so much easier to do all this stuff before you have kids. But she had a year's internship in which she simply couldn't do stuff at home. You know, she came home at the end of the day, but she was commuting. It was, whereas I was a graduate student with the usual completely flexible schedule. And it became that year just recalibrated our habits about how you dealt with it. Okay, so then we moved to Madison. I started as an assistant professor. We had our two children, and the equality in the household began to deteriorate. And then I came up with the bright idea, which my wife initially rolled her eyes at. I said, okay, look, why don't we, instead of trying to divide up tasks, why don't we just say for 3 months I will do everything, and then for the next 3 months you'll do everything. So if we rotate, having full responsibility in the course of a year, it'll be equal. But I'll take all responsibility. I'll do all the cooking, all the cleaning, and all the childcare, but I can ask you to do things. You know, you're just like in the classical male breadwinner model, the wife could say, oh, honey, would you pick up a carton of milk on your way home from work, right? So we could ask each other to help, but all the responsibility lay on one person or the other. So we tried that for several cycles, for a couple of years. Initially just thought this was ridiculous, that, you know, it would be impossible to do. It sort of worked, but it did really change my sense of the nature of the tasks and what it meant to share things. And that was my own personal point at which I felt that I really gained command of my own capacity to live my life in a more egalitarian way. Well, all of this is that's a side point. About increases in women's bargaining power, that was not a case of increasing women's bargaining power, but pay equity accomplishes that. It helps that. You have more power in the home if you bring more income into the home. And that's one of the interesting findings of research on the gender division of labor. Second point, public provision of high quality childcare. This opens choices for a work-family balance that doesn't exist if you feel there's a huge trade-off between the quality of care you can provide your own children and the quality of care that's available through daycare services. Public provision also reduces class inequalities and opportunities for women. If it all has to be privately provided through the market, the costs of childcare is just prohibitive for many working class families. And this again makes bargaining within families over the division of labor easier. If you're basically outsourcing part of your childcare because you have good quality daycare facilities, it means there's less burden on the family to divide up everything. And so a more egalitarian set of practices can emerge over time within the family. Paid parental leave. So there are three forms of paid parental leave that we see in various places in the world. Maternity leaves, only available to mothers. Parental leaves going to families to divide among spouses as they wish. And parental leaves going separately to mothers and fathers. They each get a quota, but they can't share it. Now, of the three, the third is the one that most pushes for more equality inside of the home. You can see that if it's called use it or lose it. The family loses the paid parental leave if the husband doesn't take it. The first one reproduces the gender division of labor. Women take early childhood parental leave as maternal leave. Men don't take any. The middle one creates a battleground for how this is to be divided up. The middle version is the one that was introduced in Sweden and other Northern European countries, initially in the form of a unified family leave in which either parent could take it. But gradually they've added side conditions so that some of that leave has to be taken by men. And what we've observed over time is that slowly, but nevertheless consistently, men have begun to take more parental leaves than they did in the past. It's still the case in Sweden that I think 2/3 or 3/4 of early childhood parental leaves are taken by mothers rather than 50-50, but it's been inching up towards 50-50 over time. What do people of your generation really want? How much of these ideas actually are resonating with the lives of people? This is the report of research done by a sociologist at NYU named Kathleen Gerson. Research she did with basically undergraduates at NYU, where she teaches, asking them about their ideals for the kind of families they would like to have in the future. So there are three possible ideals. The egalitarian model is one where both mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, both share in the domestic division of labor of both housework and child care, and both are fully engaged in the in their professional lives. They have careers as well. The second, the neo-traditional family, is one where there's a male breadwinner and the wife isn't necessarily a full-time homemaker, but she adjusts her career and her work schedule and how much she works to be compatible with what her husband does. So the husband is the male breadwinner, the what used to be also called the head of the family. The wife may work, but always in a form that's adjusting to the requirements of her husband's work. That is the neo-traditional family. And this self-reliant family is the one in which the wife ensures, each person ensures that they can do it alone. They don't count on the household as a secure haven within which they'll work and live. They will ensure that they will have a full-time professional career, and they adjust their family life to make that possible. You know, so being self-reliant is the crucial thing. If you can't be egalitarian, well, you're going to be self-reliant. Well, here's the interesting thing in her research. People were asked, well, what's your ideal? You know, if you could just snap your fingers and imagine the life you want to live, which of these three models feels best? So people ranked number one. And then they were asked, well, if you can't have number one, what's your second choice? We'll call that your fallback position. If you can't have your ideal, if that's just not going to work out, you can't find the right partner who will do it with you, or for whatever reason. I don't think in the research she gave people a scenario. You know, she didn't tell them a story why it didn't work out. She just said, what's your second choice? What's your fallback? Well, the first thing to note, and I think this is really important, at least among this sample of undergraduates, you know, fairly affluent undergraduates at NYU, men and women really shared the same kind of ideal. It's not that the men wanted a stay-at-home mom wife or a subservient wife who would adjust everything to meet his needs. It's not that they envisioned as their ideal a reproduction of an earlier generation's vision of a patriarchal family with the male at the center and everybody else adjusting their lives to satisfy the needs of the man. No, their ideals are not that different from women. Certainly the most frequent one was the egalitarian family ideal. Now that's important to know, even if we observe that in young families being formed, that egalitarian ideal isn't achieved in most cases. It's important to know that it is still part of the ideals that people are holding. But when asked what your preferred fallback position is, there you get a really sharp difference between men and women. Very few men say that their fallback position is, if we can't have an egalitarian ideal, then I'd like to just do it on my own. You know, I would rather just, if I have a partner, that's fine, but I'm not going to in any way rely on the partner. I'm just going to assure that my own career and my own needs are satisfied independently. Whereas for women, if the dominant, among NYU students, the dominant fallback is, well, my fallback, I sure don't want a neo-traditional family. I'm not going to do that. If I can't have the egalitarian ideal, I'm going to do the self-reliant ideal. So there's a big conflict over the second best, but not over the optimal. Now, this may be a peculiar sample from NYU students. I kind of suspect it wouldn't be all that different at Wisconsin, but nobody's done the research here. Be a nice undergraduate thesis for somebody to do, you know. Do it. You can do a little survey in a bunch of classes, get professors to go along with it. You could see, is this true in Wisconsin, not just in cosmopolitan New York? I suspect it would be rather simple. Well, what's the lesson here? So some people would say, aha, you see, men really haven't changed that much. For me, the lesson is we have to think about the policies that would make it possible for people to live their ideal. Make it easy for people, not hard for people. We need paid parental leaves. That'll make it easier for people to live the egalitarian ideal. Really generous paid parental leaves don't guarantee that people translate that into more equality in their intimate relations in their household, but it sure makes it easier to fight about it and for the egalitarian direction to gradually emerge. Public provision of high quality childcare. Let's make it easier for parents so that they don't bear that full burden. I especially like the Quebec model, which I've written about, because the Quebec model not only is heavily subsidized and not only provides living wages for the caregivers, those daycare centers are also organized as cooperatives in which the board of directors of the daycare centers are elected by parents, workers, and community members interested in childcare. So they're not government run, they're government funded, but they're community run. And it's a really nice formula for having community involvement and parental involvement in the centers in which their children are being taken care of. And pay equity. Let's make it easier for the resources in the family to come equally from mothers and fathers. If we do these three reforms, then we make it easier for people to turn their ideals into the practices within their own intimate lives. And that's the way I think to think about policy, policy reforms. Does it enable or disable people to seek the kinds of lives which they want? These reforms, therefore, should be thought of as enhancing freedom of individuals, even though the reforms themselves are expensive. They require taxation. This is, you know, getting back to a theme from the first part of the course. It requires an affirmative state that's capable of allocating resources for public purposes, but these are public purposes that enhance the freedom of people to put their life ideals into place. Well, next week you have a little test on Tuesday. That will be, it'll be untimed like the previous one, and this time we've organized our affairs so that there's no problems about the lack of, you know, no time constraint. And then we will begin on Thursday our adventure in thinking about democracy. See you then.